You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa. No mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Sanat. Efa Kane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about the results of the New Zealand Herald's Mood of the Boardroom survey and the university reforms announced by the government earlier this month. For International Desk, I spoke to Dr. Marika Reithoff, Senior Lecturer in Latin American Politics at the University of Liverpool, about the conviction of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro and the public response. Sanat, what have you got for us today?
On City Counselling this week, I talked to Councillor Julie Ferry about the passing of Plan Change 78 and higher density housing in the city. I also had a chat with Te Ohu Whakawhanaunga's lead organiser, Marlon Drake, about the 300-person mayoral forum that was hosted last week on housing and wages.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rane, give us a call in studio on 3093879. Ka awa e wari wari I ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakeheri rukiruki mārongi I te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fetu Iwa 3093879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Yesterday, the New Zealand Herald released their latest Mood of the Boardroom survey results based on the responses from 150 senior business leaders. The Prime Minister ranked 15th in Cabinet, while Finance Minister Nicola Willis ranked 13th. And earlier this month, the Minister for Universities, Dr. Shane Retty, announced a series of reforms for tertiary education. The reforms include initiatives such as developing a new tertiary education strategy and strengthening the regulatory system for universities. The reforms are taken from the advice of the government's University Advisory Group, which created recommendations for the future direction of New Zealand universities. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked Shannon Halbert about both of these topics. I started by asking about what he thinks the Mood of the Boardroom survey says about people's faith in the current government.
Well, it's never really a good sign when the Prime Minister is ranked 15th in his own cabinet. I think he would be quite concerned about that. And this is feedback from his own people, you know. They're all CEOs, and their response to him hasn't been favourable. So the government will be disappointed.
There seems to be some excitement about Barbara Edmonds as a future finance minister, but people are unsure about Labour's tax policy. When will we know more?
Chris Hipkins has said that Labour's tax policy will be announced before the end of the year. I think the focus of Mood of the Boardroom, you know, was in response to the lack of leadership from Nicola Willis and from Prime Minister Christopher Luxon. They made big promises over the past couple of years. They haven't been able to deliver on that. And people feel that we're going backwards when it comes to the economy and cost of living. So Barbara is a real breath of fresh air to everyone. I think she brings a perspective that understands economics and tax. But also, you know, with 8 children, Barbara understands the importance of running a family household.
Do you think there's space for Labour to be the new numbers party?
I think Labour's always been the numbers party, but the point of difference of what we stand for is that we believe an economy that looks after everyone. What we've seen under this government is that they have really backed tobacco companies, landlords, but we know that we're feeling the pinch on the ground. The average family is really struggling to meet the cost of living requirements on a daily basis, whether that is about the increasing rents that we're seeing, the cost of food. You know, those are the real areas where we get to test whether an economy is working. The part that I'm most concerned about is the increasing unemployment rates that we're seeing here in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland. They're only going upwards. That's not a good economy.
The big question on everyone's minds is, will Labor campaign on a capital gains tax? Is there any update in this area?
We've committed to taking forward both a capital gains tax and a wealth tax for further investigation. That was what our members and our party asked of us. That work is being done. You know, both come with different challenges and both come with different opportunities. And the thing for us is we need to work out how we communicate that with the public, and if that was to go forward, what that money would be invested in is most critical. But Labor is focused on jobs, health, homes and getting real action on the cost of living. So, you know, that's a signal of where that money would go towards should we move forward on either of those taxes.
Earlier this month, the government announced reforms surrounding universities. What is your response to this proposal?
Yeah, this government has taken forward a really ideological view of tertiary education. We've seen the rollback of vocational education in this country and, you know, more than 1,000 jobs lost as a result, courses cut and campuses being closed because of the decisions and choices of this government. So when it comes to universities, I was at University of Canterbury yesterday. As I go around the country talking about the tertiary education strategy that's in front of everyone for consultation, the concerns that I'm hearing really is that the government is too focused on growth. They've forgotten about learners and the priority of education being a public good. And what I'm hearing directly from students is that they're very upset about the increase, 6% increase to student fees at a time when people are feeling the pinch of cost of living. So, you know, the government is really out of touch with what students and universities are looking for. They've taken a long time to move the tertiary education strategy for the next 3 years through, and I've asked Minister Reti to work in a bipartisan way so that, you know, most of all we can give certainty to the sector.
There's been a lot of criticism from certain members of the coalition government towards support that targets Māori and Pacifica students. I want to flip that narrative and instead ask, what is the importance of this support, and do you think there should be new or additional strategies to support these students?
What we've seen over the past two decades is successful investment into addressing inequities in our education system, and that largely impacts Māori and Pacific learners. We know that Māori and Pacific learners are still falling behind both in the number of enrolments and the number of completions and graduations across the tertiary sector, but we know there is success when there's targeted strategies in place. So when we talk about MAPAS, which directly is about supporting Māori and Pacific students into health careers, whether that be medicine or nursing as examples, those are effective strategies that offer pastoral support, academic support to ensure that those learners are successful, supported and achieving what they need to go into those relevant workforces. The constant attack from government members on equity funding has been incredibly disappointing. It takes our country backwards because we know we need to grow, for example, a health workforce. And we know with the growing population of Māori and Pacific people that we need a health workforce that reflects the diversity of our communities, and we need to invest in that. So, you know, it's just politics, it's just ideology when people start to attack targeted funding that's based on ethnicity. You know, there's a real need there, and nobody can argue against the evidence in support of that.
The government isn't taking on every recommendation from their university advisory group. One example of what the government rejected was a recommendation to create a more elite university system that's more separate from other tertiary institutions. Do you agree with the decision not to go down this pathway?
I agree with the fact that that would require a bit more work. There needs to be stability across the university sector. With our eight universities, we need to understand how they can work together, how they can be producing the graduates that we need. We've seen the government attack both, you know, arts and commerce, and they've argued that STEM subjects become more of a priority. The reality is that we need to support every learner in the tertiary sector, no matter what they're studying, and universities have a role to play in that. There is a point, I think, that needs further investigation, which is when we're competing against the rest of the world, that we need to ensure that our universities are competitive and that they stack up. And the recommendation was one way in which we might achieve that, but we need to look at other ways as well.
Was there anything else not covered in the announcement or the report that you'd like to be part of any immediate tertiary education reforms?
Well, we've seen the government double down on what the sector has called erasing Te Tiriti in legislation and in the strategy. The feedback has been quite concerning and alarming for them that they've started to dilute the role that Māori, iwi, mana whenua play in the tertiary education strategy and the roll-on effect for Pacific and ethnic communities participating in the sector. So, you know, I want some immediate action on that. We worked hard in the last Labor government to include Te Tiriti and targeted funding where it's needed. So to have a strategy that dilutes that is problematic in my view, and I would look to that sooner rather than later.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on the results of the New Zealand Herald's Mood of the Boardroom survey and the university reforms announced by the government earlier this month.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council's Policy and Planning Committee met yesterday to vote on a new plan that would zone the city for 2 million homes, primarily around train stations and rapid bus routes. This plan is a response to legislation put forward by Housing Minister Chris Bishop, which requires councils across the country to zone for higher density housing. This plan has not been without controversy, with councillors claiming that Aucklanders are, quote, being put to the firing squad. Deputy PM David Seymour has publicly disagreed with his own housing minister, arguing that suburbs like Epsom and Parnell don't have the right infrastructure to accommodate for this growth. However, advocates for this plan, including Mayor Wayne Brown, argue that the council cannot continue to drag its feet on the need for housing that is closer to the city and is more affordable. They argue that it's better to build in places with pipes, public transport routes, and job opportunities. The plan passed with a majority last evening, so I talked to Councillor Julie Ferry about the plan change and what it means for the future of the city.
Julie, could you maybe walk me through a little bit about what this plan promises for the future of the city?
So the main thing this plan promises is more housing. And the choice that Council had was between two plans that overall would create the same extra capacity for housing. But importantly, the difference with the one that we passed is that a lot more of that housing is going to be close to transport hubs, close to town centres, and away from flood risk. That's the really big difference on the housing front between the two plans. And obviously it's not perfect. You know, nobody there yesterday put their hand up and said, this is amazing and perfect and we don't need to change it anymore. There's a process to go through for public submissions, for hearings. There'll be independent commissioners who assess all the inputs and go, okay, this is how we polish this up and make it better. And council will be an active participant in that process, although those commissioners will then decide the final shape, bring it back to council probably in about 18 months, and then council will vote on, okay, this is the new plan, and after that it will start to take effect. So, yeah, huge win for the compact city. a much better plan than the alternative on lowering emissions, way better on flood protection, really important to me. So a big step forward, not there yet, definitely got a lot of work to do, but pretty exciting.
Now, opponents of the plan have argued that this, you know, the zoning will allow for capacity that we won't ever need, that there's not sufficient infrastructure in inner city suburbs, that we don't need to zone for that much housing, but also that there hasn't been enough time to consult on it, and that we should opt for more greenfield development and building outside of the city and not in suburbs like Mount Eden, Parnell, Herne Bay, and Great Lynn. What do you have to say to people who bring up that opposition to you?
I think the first thing to understand is that this process and the rush of it has been not the choosing of council at all. It's been a construct of central government choices. And while, again, nobody put their hand up yesterday and said, I like this process so far, there, you know, it is born of frustration from central government, both the previous government and this government, that they've now passed two laws going back to 2021 saying, Auckland Council, you're not doing enough on housing. So while this process has been very short, and Councillor Richard Hills, who's led the process from the council end, wanted central government to pass their legislation back in at the latest May, June, so that we could do some pre-consultation with the community, central government chose to pass it in late August, giving us no time. It is still, like for councillors at least, none of this is a surprise. We have been working on workshops towards this. We thought the process might be a little bit different from this, but we've been working on this literally probably for over a year. So this is not new. And so there's that. Around the infrastructure, all of the information we've had repeatedly from staff, from Watercare, from Auckland Transport, from the Chief Economist for Council, is that the infrastructure is there now for quite a lot of this capacity in the central area where we are pushing it. And finally, it's really important to understand that there's a difference between how much capacity we enable through the plan and how much will ultimately be built. There was a lot of discussion ahead of yesterday and again a little bit yesterday too about the idea of staging. Firstly, legally, we can't do that with this kind of plan change. You can't say, this part of the city, you can do 10 stories in the next 5 years, and then after that, you can do it in another part of the city. You actually can't do that legally with these kinds of processes. But the other thing is that the more we restrict where you can do this kind of building, where you can build these different types of housing as well, then the less likely you are to get the ultimate outcomes that you're after as a city, because we do rely on the market to do that building. And if we restrict them, then that puts the cost of the land in the restricted area up a lot and makes it much less commercially viable that they will actually be able to do it. We potentially get in a situation where we're saying to people, hey, because your land has to, you know, needs to be this, you know, 10 stories in the next 5 years, there's a lot of pressure on that landowner. They're going to be living in their family home on that site. And then we get close to requiring people to do stuff with their land, which is just not how we work as a city, as a country. So, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff tied up in with some of these ideas that might seem very common sense, but actually when you start to peel away, well, hang on, how would that play out? You start to get into some stuff quite quickly that is not the way that New Zealanders or Aucklanders like to acknowledge property rights and things like that. Yeah,
it's interesting. You mentioned that, you know, we're relying on the market to deliver this housing as well. And I suppose this might be more of a question aimed at the relationship between central government and local government. But there's a question of affordable housing. Will this improve housing affordability for Aucklanders? Because we know that the lack of density has been bumping up the value of land and the value of housing, particularly in these inner city suburbs, but the housing that is proposed to be delivered through this plan will be delivered through the market, through private developers. What sort of...
Yeah, we had some interesting debate about that yesterday. I mean, the advice, not just from the council economist, whose, you know, job is it is to know this stuff and explain it, but also from a lot of other commentators, is that the key thing that is increasing the price of housing for Auckland at the moment is the cost of land. And I asked the economist directly about this yesterday, you know, explain how does this work? How does having, you know, increasing how high you can go close to train stations actually decrease the cost of housing? And there's a couple of different ways, but the key thing that he explained was that because when you build up, you have more units on a single piece of land, that brings down the cost per unit of the land, which is the highest portion of the price, right? So if you've got, say you've got 10 apartments on a piece of land, the cost of that piece of land then gets divided by 10 across them. Perhaps not evenly. You might have a, you know, a penthouse, a fancy one. You might have something at ground level that's more basic, whatever. But it brings down the biggest component of the cost of buying into that development, which is the land. The other thing that it does is it gives us more capacity of different types of housing. And that's really important. Single houses, so standalone, largely three-bedroom houses, have been the predominant type of housing in Auckland for a long time. They're still actually the most common type of housing that we build as a city, even though we've been making changes to encourage other types. And they just don't suit everybody at every stage of their life. And they're quite expensive. They're expensive to build as well as taking up quite a large piece of land, which again, large component of the price. And so if you start to have these different types of housing, particularly if you have them close to transport, then you start to give people more choice about, hey, actually at this time of my life, an apartment suits me better, or a townhouse, or a duplex, or hey, as a first home buyer, I don't have to save a massive deposit to get into a three-bedroom house. I could buy a unit. And, you know, then later on in life, when perhaps my situation changes and I need a larger property, I could go into that. And so you start to also free up some of those houses that are too big for the people that are in them now. They start to have options to move within their own neighbourhood to something smaller that suits them. And all of this stuff has an impact on price. So it's, yeah, I'm really excited particularly about the different types of housing we're going to get and the idea that people can stay in their neighbourhood when their life situation changes. They don't have to move away, lose connection, lose access to services. Because you know their situation changed and they couldn't afford or didn't need a big house anymore, they'll be able to buy an apartment in the town centre or you know, a brick and tile unit maybe next door and keep those connections. That's something I'm particularly excited about.
That was Julie Ferry on the passing of Plan Change 78 and what zoning for high density housing promises for the future of the city in terms of housing affordability.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text 5395 any of your thoughts on any of these pieces and we'll be back shortly.
Get ready for a fun extravaganza this school holiday at We The Young.
A brand new hands-on festival for young people. Step inside and build a magical paper world.
Answer some of the universe's biggest questions at Creation.
Experience a giant-sized chess set.
And learn some new circus moves in Altair Square. We the Young, Tuesday 16th till Sunday 28th of September. Don't miss this epic adventure for your whānau these school holidays. Check out more at aucklandlive.co.nz.
Roll a nat 20 on your plans this week with improvised Dungeons & Dragons theatre show. Can I get an underground location and a mythical creature?
Roll the dice for the players and see what happens.
Will the wizard fight the dragon?
Will the goblin drink the poison?
Will the mystical beast fall in love with the bard and set everyone free?
Can I get an underground location and a mythical creature? Pump House Theatre. On now till Sunday. Tickets from pumphouse.co.nz.
What can I get for you?
Yeah, can I grab a funky wasp?
Smooth or seedy?
Just how it comes is fine.
You are the best of me. Son of a bitch.
So quite a complicated... Quite a complicated drink then.
What? Yeah. I'm going to be 37.50, mate. Actually, just make it 37, because I like your attitude.
Cocktail Corner. Five Thirsty every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive. Thanks to Decibel Wines.
Jazz Cigarette. Bob Hope. Durbridge.
Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot?
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Bye.
four, three, two, one.
International Desk.
Our go.
Earlier this month, 4 out of 5 members of Brazil's Supreme Court voted to convict the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, for plotting a military coup after losing the 2022 election. However, members of Brazil's right-wing political opposition that support Bolsonaro are attempting to pass a bill that would give him amnesty. Earlier this week, thousands of Brazilians protested against the proposed amnesty bill, which has been dubbed by critics as the Bandits Bill. For International Desk, I spoke to Dr. Marika Reithoff, senior lecturer in Latin American politics at the University of Liverpool, about this conviction of Bolsonaro and the public response. I started by asking if, for those who don't know, she could talk about who Bolsonaro is and what he has been convicted of.
So Jair Bolsonaro was elected president in 2018, and he was known from the very start of his election campaigns as a far-right ideologist, someone who supported all kinds of conservative views against women, against Brazilian minorities, and also rejected, in a way, the previous left-wing governments under the presidency of Dilma Rousseff and President Lula, left-wing policies, and proposed a much more positive relationship with the United States, which is also important for the conviction case. And Bolsonaro came to power based on a very significant amount of social mobilization, mass demonstrations. So he had and has significant support. And during his presidency, he was still popular, but also controversial because of his handling of the pandemic. And there were many Brazilian victims at the time. And he ended up losing the elections against his main nemesis, you could say, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in 2022. Bolsonaro always presented Lula as one of the main enemy of his far-right program. And after Lula was elected, Bolsonaro instigated the storming of the Brazilian Congress and institutions of democracy in the capital, Brasilia. Although that was initially, it seemed spontaneous, it later appeared to be planned by Bolsonaro and his accomplices. And now he's been convicted for this case, which is why a majority of Brazilians accepted as an attempted coup. Around 64% view it that way.
That links well into the next question I have, which is, how have people in Brazil responded to these convictions?
I found it very interesting that the level of demonstrations before and after the conviction and the verdict were relatively small compared to the past. So you could speak of several thousand people demonstrating in favor of Bolsonaro compared to much larger demonstrations about 10 years ago leading up to his election. As I said, a majority of Brazilians supports the verdict, but there's still quite a lot of polarization around it. And Bolsonaro and his allies have a hardcore support of around 20% of the electorate.
There is also a new bill introduced by the opposition in Brazil that could grant Bolsonaro amnesty. Where has this bill come from and how likely is it to pass?
So the opposition, particularly in the lower chamber of deputies, has proposed a bill for what is called a bird amnesty, which would remove the convictions and the prison sentences. And this proposal would mean that Bolsonaro wouldn't serve in prison, but he would still be banned from running in elections for breaking several electoral laws. This proposal is now has been kind of sent to a reporter in Parliament who is looking at the possibilities for an amnesty. But the official looking at this has already reported that an amnesty is very unlikely to pass. It would be a constitutional amendment, so it needs a two-thirds majority vote. At the same time, the more moderate opposition is looking for a legal proposal to reduce the sentences of those convicted to from coup plotting, and that's more likely to pass. But President Lula has already said that if there is an amnesty voted for in Parliament, then he would consider vetoing it. So he's very much opposed to the idea of an amnesty.
What has the response been to the amnesty bill from the public in Brazil?
So that's also interesting in that a small majority of Brazilians also support the convictions, but not an amnesty. So in reality, I think there's not a lot of public support for this. That's coupled with the majority view of around 64% that this was indeed a coup attempt and it should be there should be consequences.
Bolsonaro was also ideologically aligned with United States President Donald Trump. What does Bolsonaro's conviction mean for Trump and the United States?
Trump was interviewed almost immediately after the convictions. And he said, you know, that he likes Bolsonaro and he views him as a close ally. But he also saw the legal prosecution of Bolsonaro as similar to his own experience of the many court cases he faced. And you can see now that Marco Rubio, in particular, has been speaking out against conviction also. More recently, but there hasn't been any specific threat of sanctions. The US has already applied trade sanctions on Brazil, which is not necessarily very significant because Brazil imports more from the US than it exports to the US. And there's been a case of diplomatic sanctions, so not allowing visas for diplomatic delegations. But it doesn't look like the US can interfere directly in this way. And Lula has also spoken out against it, including in an article in the New York Times.
I believe this is the first time Brazilian politicians have been convicted for inciting a coup. Is this a good sign for democracy?
I would definitely say so, because Bolsonaro has in quite a few ways, and Bolsonaro and his allies, I should say, have been undermining democracy, so questioning the electoral process in Brazil, questioning certain accepted protections and rights, and democratic institutions, and that has led to concerns about democratic backsliding in Brazil, but it looks like, compared to some other countries, including in the US and in Europe, Brazil's institutions can provide a safety net. So that can actually lead to convictions like this and can indicate consequences of something like a coup. And that's very important given the history of dictatorship in Brazil.
That was Dr. Marika Reithoff, senior lecturer in Latin American politics at the University of Liverpool, on the conviction of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro and the public response.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week at St. Matthew's in the City, the Community Alliance Te Ohu Whakawhanaunga organized a housing and wages mayoral forum attended by nearly 300 people. This forum was centered on asking leading mayoral candidates Karen Leone and Wayne Brown about their plans to deliver public and affordable housing in the city, tackle homelessness, and deliver a living wage for all those employed by Auckland Council. I spoke to lead organizer for Te Ohu Tamaki, Marlon Drake, about their community organizing strategy, the sort of issues that diverse communities across the city care about, and how they plan to work with the next mayor of the city to deliver on the needs of communities in Auckland. So, last week, Te Ohu Whakamanunga hosted a mayoral forum with the two leading mayoral candidates, Wayne Brown and Karen Leone. Before we get into any of that, though, maybe you could describe to me a little bit about yourself and the work that you're doing as part of the organization.
So kia ora, ko Marlon Drake tōku ingoa. I'm lead organiser of Te Ohu Whakawhanaunga Tāmaki Makaurau, which is a community alliance up here in Tāmaki made up of over 40 faith, union and community organisations. Our focus is to build relationships across civil society, across different communities, find that common ground, those commonly held values, those commonly held issues and things that people care about and want to solve, and then actually work together to do deep community organising to solve those things through action, civic participation, all that kind of stuff. So we not only build relationships and strategise, but also run trainings in the community on how to do those things in a way which is effective and gets you wins.
So what are the sort of organisations that make up this coalition that you're building, and what are the sort of issues that they're echoing back to you that they want to see change on?
Yeah, so we have a wonderful host of union organisations, including Air 2 Union, the Maritime Union of New Zealand, Unite Union, NZEI, NZNO, TU. We have a whole range of different community organisations, which I want to know. They include, for example, Isle of Avondale, a local Avondale-based community organisation, Sisters of Mercy Wiri, which is a little nuns convent out in Wiri in Marerewa, a wonderful group out there. And then, of course, our faith organisations, and we have a variety of faith organisations from the from different denominations and also different religions as well. And I guess the way that we identify what an issue is comes from this tool we use called a listening campaign. So we don't do sort of surveys. We go out, we have community meetings, we sit there, listen to people share their stories, and then from that we let the community and the community leaders decide what the focus will be. So over the last couple of years, one big focus, and you can imagine this is obvious almost in Auckland, has been on housing. And housing has been sort of a leading campaign for us. Recently also, Te Ohu Tāmaki has chosen to support the living wage movement, which pre-exists us, but we're now involved in supporting that organisation, in that movement. As well as that, we're doing work around decent work in the health and care sector. The Avondale Race Course is a project which Te Ohu is endorsing, the Avondale Racecourse Alliance, making sure there's a community-led vision for the future of that whenua, and period poverty as well, where we have an ongoing listening campaign, plus a whole range of local issues. We always kind of want member organisations to run local campaigns around things like road crossings, transport infrastructure in the community, whatever that thing may be.
Now, you had a mayoral forum last week. What was that particularly focused on, and what were the sort of issues that like differentiate the candidates? What, you know, what do they have the biggest splits on?
Yeah, so last week we held our Wages and Houses Mayoral Forum, where we had Wayne Brown and Councillor Corinne Leone. We only invited those two for this time, because otherwise it's just too many different candidates, so we thought we'd stick with the incumbents. The focus of that action was around the living wage, in particular the living wage for council directly employed and contracted workers, but also for the council-controlled organisations and Auckland Transport, Ports of Auckland, for example, Tātaki Unlimited, Auckland Stadiums and so forth. And those organisations, we also put forward an ask and a call for a commitment to pay those workers the living wage as well, which would be a new big win for us up here in Tāmaki. The other issue was around housing, and we had a range of different asks centred around the right to a decent home and council's role in making sure that every Aucklander's right to a decent home is fulfilled. And that is a sort of underpinning principle of all campaigning work we do. And one of the things that included was an affordable housing plan for Auckland. You may be shocked to hear that Auckland Council once had an affordable housing plan, and then sort of got rid of it and said, oh, we'll just do it as business as usual, but that's meant that nothing's really happened around it. As well as that, we called on the mayoral candidates to commit to increasing the homelessness budget, which you may have seen on RNZ, and also an ask around joint advocacy to central government on state housing, which we know is being slung off up here in Auckland like dollar lolly bags, and is an absolute disaster waiting to happen.
Another thing that I'm really interested in understanding is, you know, when we talk about local elections and local government, this direly low voter turnout, people aren't showing up to engage in these issues and stuff, but you guys somehow managed to get 300 people to show up in an evening to talk about these issues. Can you speak a little bit about how you think your organizing strategy and philosophy could help improve community engagement and local democracy in general?
Totally. Well, yeah, I've got two answers to that. One is the model that we use is relational community organizing. So we go out and build face-to-face relationships with different community leaders and then within those communities and those organizations as well. And that's a process which takes time. It's not flashy. It requires sitting in tension with cultures and communities you may not understand. And it requires patience and understanding. It can take a couple of years to build an infrastructure, a people-powered infrastructure that can do that. But that's the thing that works when it comes to community organizing and it comes to building people power and it comes to getting long-lasting systems change of the kind that many of our member organizations and myself believe that we need. So it's that process of, it seems kind of old school, but, you know, our social media isn't flashy. We don't have much going on there. But if you look at our alliance, it's a broad range of different people from across the city, different ethnic groups, different faiths, different ages, all sorts of different class. And the reason that we can get those people in the room, and those are all representatives of their organizations and communities, is through the ongoing process of face-to-face conversations. In regards to the voter turnout problem, there's an issue there that we see, which is that candidates simply don't door knock like they used to. And door knocking and direct voter contact and canvassing on the doors is proven through evidence, like studies that have been done, scientific studies, to be the most effective way to turn out votes. And yet so few candidates do it. The ones that do typically do very well, and the ones that don't typically don't. But what you have is a whole bunch of people who every election time never hear from their candidates, never, you don't even know who their local people are, aside from a few social media posts, which they're not even on the algorithm for, or a hoarding that is one of those billboard signs that you see as well. But actually what we need is face-to-face, on-the-doors conversations. Those aren't happening, and that's why voter turnout isn't increasing and is in fact dropping. Same goes for the general election too.
Now, the incumbent Wayne Brown, currently leading in the polls and said to be possibly, you know, a shoe-in for the mayoralty, he has not been showing up to mayoral forums across the city. It's really great that you guys had him at yours. But I suppose the question I wanted to ask here is, you know, if he is going to be the mayor for the next 3 years, and he disagreed with some of the key asks that you guys had at an organizing level around affordable housing and the homelessness budget as well. How do you think you're going to work with a mayor like that who disagrees with what communities are bringing to him?
All I can say is that he was pretty open to us on the night. So we received full commitments on the living wage asks, and we received two full commitments and two compromises on our housing asks. So we're looking forward to having a pretty good working relationship with him, like we did in the last term as well. I think the thing about working with this mayor and the same as any mayor is that it's just a constant tussle of meetings and compromises, and also recognizing that there are 21 votes around the table. Our councils don't work the same way that councils do in America, where the mayor has absolute power. They have a lot of power, they have a lot of influence, but fundamentally it comes down to votes around the table. And what we've found is that the mayor's been pretty open to supporting projects which have support, popular support around the table as well, and especially when those asks and commitments are backed up by communities that are well-organised, like ours, and also expert opinion as well. So it's always going to be a compromise. It's always going to be an ongoing conversation. It's never you have the big action and then the next day the thing is done. That is not a realistic strategy for change. So for us, what we're now looking forward to is, okay, for the next over, this is, of course, whoever the mayor is, we'll make a plan to work with them, and we'll do that as an alliance and develop a strategy around that. But not just that mayor, but also the 21, or the 20 rather, other councillors, and then the independent Māori statutory board members as well, who also hold a vote on various key committees.
That was lead organiser Marlon Drake on the Te Ohu Mayoral Forum and engagement in local elections.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa e korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, University of Liverpool's Dr. Marika Reithoff, Auckland Council's Julie Ferry, and Te Ohu Whakawhanonga's Marlon Drake. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.